Disclaimer: the views and opinions expressed in Radio DMG may or may not be the views and opinions of the DMGI's family of sites. All music used in this podcast is the property of whoever made it, and no copyright infringement is intended. God bless this albatross, and hold on tight for the awesome you're about to receive.
It's good to be the king.
Welcome to this episode of Radio DMG. I am your host, Philip Wesley. Today is March 15th, 2011, and this is the first of four episodes that deal with Anime Land Wasabi 2011. Now, our first one will have an interview with Liesl Wilkerson, and we also have a good amount of newsity to get through as well. So, stay glued to your seats, keep those headphones on, and sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of Radio DMG. Now let's go ahead and bring up the newsity. The biggest newsity this week is the ongoing efforts to sort out the aftermath of the Sendai earthquake that hit Japan. I would like to take a moment to show some appreciation toward the reactions of groups and companies like Nintendo, who donated 300 million yen to the effort, Sony Group, who donated 300 million yen to the effort, plus over 30,000 radios, Sega Sammy, who donated 200 million yen, Square Enix, who turned off their online servers to conserve electricity during the cleanup efforts, and Tecmo Koi, who donated 10 million yen, Namco Bandai, who donated 100 million yen, and several other American companies who have banded together to show support for the people who were caught in the earthquake and the resulting tsunami, and to help aid with the rebuilding efforts. We're not going to go too much into that, but we are going to go ahead and look at some of the events, some of how the event has affected some of the game development over there in Japan. There have been numerous delays, mostly on the console side of things. On the portable side of things, there were a couple PSP games that were delayed, and Capcom of Japan canceled all six of their upcoming Monster Hunter Festa events over concerns of safety for the people who'll be traveling to the events. There's also a couple interesting charity efforts going on. There's apparently on March 24th or 25th, I have to verify it, Kotaku is having a charity ball or charity gala here in Denver to help support the victims of the tsunami and the victims of the earthquake. A bunch of anime websites are hosting a 24-hour-long podcast, and they're going to have it's essentially a charity, you know, one of those little telethons kind of, but online. They're streaming a 24-hour long broadcast, and they're getting several voice actors into the mix, including apparently Crispin Freeman, Spike Spencer, a couple other people. So that should be interesting. I'll have a link to that in our show notes. So that's a bit depressing, because a lot of other stuff that, looking through our list of stuff that's been canceled or been delayed, numerous shows have been delayed from airing. There's a couple PSP games that have been delayed. So far, no delays on the Nintendo side of things, but there's been a lot of console games. For example, the PlayStation 3 game, Disaster Report 4, was flat out canceled. And a couple of their other efforts were also hit with major delays. To compensate for this and to help raise money, companies like Capcom and Sega have lowered the prices of their iPhone games, like Sonic the Hedgehog, Sonic the Hedgehog 2, the iPhone version of Super Street Fighter 4. They've lowered the price of those to about 99 cents, and then promised that all proceeds, all the money that those make, will be donated to charity. Now, I don't really recommend buying iPhone games, but essentially, this is buy a terrible game for charity, and we can support that. In happier news, Parasite Eve was released on PlayStation Network in the United States today, this Tuesday, as well as Final Fantasy Dissidia. It's Dissidia 012 Duodecim Prologus Final Fantasy. It's a 3 or 4 level demo deal that you have to pay for because it comes with all sorts of DLC. It's weird, but that came out yesterday on DSiWare. Plants vs. Zombies was released on Nintendo DSiWare. The DSi version is the single-player only section of the retail game. It's missing a couple of the little extras, and it's missing all the multiplayer options. However, it is $8. But if you're willing to pay, and you feel that the multiplayer options and some of the extra mini games and some of the extra content is worth about $12 more, the retail version is also available. Let's see. As for animation news, Disney released some pretty good news. Apparently, the very awful Robert Zemeckis film Mars Needs Moms bombed in the box office, so they canceled his upcoming adaptation of the Yellow Submarine, which is essentially, it was going to be a motion-captured, computer-generated imagery, animated, hideous version of the very poppy and trippy old Beatles movie. So, thankfully, Disney axed that, and quick. They did release, however, some interesting new screenshots of The Ballad of Nessie, which is an animated short that they're going to be including before Winnie the Pooh when that comes out in theaters this year. Similar to how Pixar likes to put animated films in front of a lot of their films, like, for example, Cars 2 will have the first Toy Story short in front of it, Winnie the Pooh will have The Ballad of Nessie. It looks a little bit like The Reluctant Dragon, and it's also a traditionally animated film. Should be pretty great. Now, we're going to go into our new featured section. I've got new music for it, and this one is an interview with Liesl Wilkerson at Anime Land Wasabi 2011. There is some background noise, as it was conducted in a cafe, but think of it as atmosphere for the interview. Put on some headphones, which you should have on already, and enjoy. Do keep in mind, though, that we edited part of this interview, because NDAs and other little items, you'll know when we get to that part, and we'll continue to remind you of that part as the interview goes along. So sit back, enjoy our brand new feature music, and enjoy this, our first interview from our four-part coverage for Anime Land Wasabi 2011. This is Philip from Radio DMG, and we're going to conduct an interview with Lisa Wilkerson. Yes, go ahead and say hi to our studio audience, which isn't here.
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name's Lisa Wilkerson.
And what is it that you do?
Well, I do a wide range of things. I am currently here in Denver for a game convention because I do a lot of voice acting for video games.
Like, which type of video games? Like
Tekken, baby, Tekken. So I do Nina Williams for Tekken, also Christy Montero and Zafina. And I do Virtual Fighter, Sarah Bryant, Crazy Taxi, Shenmue, a lot of so video games.
What did you do in Shenmue, real quick?
Joy.
Ah.
I also played, and I can never pronounce her name, Singhua or something.
Singhua,
or I don't know, yeah.
Something like that. So yeah, do you think they're going to make a Shenmue 3?
I've gotten so many requests, actually so many emails about that. People finding me on IMDb, whatever, and asking me that question. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. I think it all depends. The only reason probably they haven't come up with a Shenmue 3, and I know a lot of people are wanting one, is just what's gone on, I think, behind the scenes with Sega. There have been, you know, some buyouts here and there, and all kinds of, you know, management changes, and so I don't know. I mean, I would love for them to make a Shenmue 3. I had an amazing time doing that game.
So, what else do you do aside from video games?
Well, I started off in voice work, actually, being a DJ.
Oh, a DJ.
So, yes, I started DJing when I was 19, which I guess it was kind of a natural progression to start doing voiceover work. And I also host, TV shows as well, like especially music-oriented TV shows, mostly in English and Japanese. So, I speak fluent Japanese and... I was in Lost in Translation as Sexy Businesswoman, and another independent film called Kamadaki, which is a French-Canadian film, and I had a pretty big role in that movie. And I also do, I just recently did the Academy Awards. I was doing the red carpet for Japan, and also I was at the Grammys doing some stuff for them. Just a lot of stuff. I last week for the first time did some simultaneous interpreting for a focus group.
Oh, what was the focus group on?
GPS navigation. Needless to say, not a field that I'm quite familiar with. It was quite the, okay, I'm jumping off into the deep end and we're going to see how it turns out.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Situation, but yeah. So I really like doing a lot of different things just because I love challenging myself in my work, and I like learning new things as well. So
since you worked on a radio before, what's the name of the shows that you worked on?
One of my favorite shows that I did was called The Lethal Weapon Show.
The Lethal Weapon.
The Lethal Weapon. Yeah, Lethal Weapon is, because my name, you know, is Lethal, and it sounds a little bit like lethal. And when I first did my show at the age of 19, a mentor of mine who's a huge DJ in Japan, he actually nicknamed me Lethal Weapon. Because in Japanese, it sounds even more like, you know, it's like, Lethal Weapon! You know, he would always call me, you know, every time I came into the studio, I'd be like, Lethal Weapon! Nani yatte no! You know, and yeah, so that's kind of how that name came about. But it was a show that I came up with the idea for, and I produced the show and directed it and hosted it it was a lifestyle show for women. I really wanted to kind of target at women and make it fun and entertaining. And yet, for me, growing up in Japan as a woman, and especially as I got older, there were a lot of topics that are never discussed in the Japanese culture, and especially in media. And you know, I mean, these are kind of more a little bit more serious topics, but stuff like breast cancer and how Japan is one of the number one growing, fastest growing, countries when it comes to breast cancer, and it's women who are a lot younger, you know, like women in their 30s who are now finding out they have breast cancer. Well, in Japan, you never get a mammogram. Women do not go to OBGYNs, you know, and they don't go to doctors. Men don't go to doctors either. And so part of what I wanted to do, and I felt the responsibility is being in media, I wanted to kind of touch on some of these subjects. And I knew that I could do it just because I'm already a foreigner. Even though I speak Japanese and I can relate to the Japanese on so many different levels, I still look foreign. So I'm very blessed in the fact that I can do things that a lot of times other Japanese people in media, Japanese women, would probably not be able to do because the Japanese would look at them as, what are you doing? You're so arrogant, thinking you can, you know, talk about this or something like that. So I tried to use my position as being a foreigner and having grown up in Japan. I really wanted to use that to kind of reach out to women and just kind of bring out a lot of topics that other people can't.
Ah. Any particular charity groups that you'd like to go ahead and mention that work with breast cancer in Japan or other types of cancer?
I did a lot of work with a charity group called Run for the Cure, which they have a chapter here in the States. They also had a chapter in Japan. I did some work with them there. I also actually did a lot of work with a charity, well, foundation that was started by a friend of mine, a fellow voice actor, actually, Kim Forsyth. And it's called Tyler's Foundation. That one is for kids with who are terminally ill. And so it's to kind of help with, like, the, you know, medical expenses and stuff like that. So those are probably the two that I really are closest to my heart, I think.
So how did you get started in voice acting for games? How did that happen?
Well, it really was a natural thing because being in radio, you get offered voice jobs, whether it's for a little commercial or, you know, or even like a lot of times emceeing for events and stuff like that. You get asked to do these things. And one of the agencies that I was doing a lot of work for started asking me to do video games. And so I probably started doing video games when I was about 22. And then just continued. I mean, it was through the agencies that I got the work, but they're one of my favorite things to do. I love doing video games.
So what was your first video game that you worked on?
Don't even remember. And the reason why, I'll give a kind of history on this. Like here in the States, I don't know how the system is, but in Japan, there's no union at all. So, and it's a buyout usually. They will pay you a certain amount of money, and it's actually usually not that big of a amount that you're getting paid. You know, it's like $700, $800 maybe for a big game, you know. So I think even for someone like, even honestly, like for Nina Williams, I think for the first time I did Nina Williams, I probably got like $1,000 for that. And you get no royalties, no nothing. Yeah. And so because of this, because there's this whole background, they don't give you information on the game. And they don't offer up information on your character or how big the game is in the gaming world.
How are you supposed to fill out your resume then?
Right, exactly. So this is the whole thing. Like, I started finding out by Googling my name. That's how I started finding out, which, you know, I was like, oh, okay. I didn't know that, you know, yeah. So, yeah, it's kind of a weird...
So, you grew up in Japan, you said at an earlier panel, which unfortunately for our listeners, we didn't get to tape.
Yeah.
But You did mention that you had been in Japan since you were 5 years old.
Correct.
What was life like growing up in Japan? Just a quick overview for our listeners.
It's definitely a unique experience. And I think because when you grow up in a different culture, you automatically, because you're surrounded by that culture, you pick up a lot of things that you don't really realize that you've picked up. And yet, of course, you have your quote-unquote native culture from being, you know, at home with your parents, whatever. So what ends up happening is they have what's called third culture kids, and it's kind of this, you know, I guess phenomenon or whatever, but you blend the two cultures and you make your own culture. And I feel that that really explains who I am, because I have a lot of Japanese things in me that are, you know, mannerisms or maybe way of thinking, and that I don't even know I have. And then it's the same with the American culture. So it's definitely a great experience. It's a little bit tough sometimes because you always stand out no matter what happens. Every day, all day, you know, it's always like, oh, gaijin da, you know, which gaijin means foreigner, you know, and so it's just like, oh, okay, I really do not want to hear that today, you know, but it's just like every day. But like if I were to do it again, I would absolutely do it. Like, I am just so thankful for the fact that I got to grow up in Japan, and of course, the anime that I grew up with was awesome.
What was your first anime?
My first anime that I remember loving so much, and I think I probably mentioned this in the panel that I had, yes, is Candy Candy. I love...
I've never heard of that one.
Yeah. I don't know if it made it over here to the States. It's just an amazing story about this girl who's an orphan, and it just kind of, she gets adopted into this family. It's a rich family, and she's just this blessed girl. She has this amazing, incredible spirit, and, you know, she falls in love with this one guy. He dies, and his name is Anthony, or Ansoni, as they say in Japanese. And I remember when he died, I was so shocked. I came home from school and I watched Candy Candy, and Anthony died. I'm like, oh, no! I went into mourning for, I think, like 3 or 4 days. I don't know. I was just, like, devastated. But then, of course, she finds a new love, who I still didn't like, and I boycotted because I still liked Anthony. But, so, yeah, Candy Candy and Arupsu no Shoujo, which is Heidi.
Oh.
The animated version of that, which is incredible. I still love that, yeah. And Sazae-san, which is a very Japanese... wonderful classic anime where all the names of the characters are actually named after fish. So even Sazae is actually a kind of fish. But it's basically a story about a Japanese family and some of the things that they go through. And it has a typical, you know, mother, father, older brother, sister, and then a baby, and then the mother, the grandma, and the grandfather also live with the family. And it's just kind of the relationship dynamics, you know, of a Japanese family. And that was also one of my favorite anime.
So what was your first video game?
Playing.
Pac-Man. And that's everybody's pretty much.
Huh?
Wasn't Pong?
No! No.
So what drew you to Pac-Man?
Right, I know.
So what drew you to Pac-Man? Just quarters? Somebody else is playing it? Like,
I love the little finger thing.
Was it in the arcade?
It was in the arcade. Yes. Someone took me, one of my girlfriends who had done it before, she took me to the arcade and she's like, oh, you have to try this. And then they came out with Miss Pac-Man and I was like, what? I love it. Yeah.
Oh. So, since you have worked in movies before, between Lost in Translation and the other movie...
Kamadaki.
Mm-hmm. Which one did you like working on the best?
The movies?
Yeah, which movie?
they were two totally different experiences. Mm. So I don't at all consider myself, I do consider myself a voice actor, and I love voice acting. I do not in any way consider myself an actress, though. Ah. I'm not really, you know, I'm not one of those, I want to be an actress and be in films. That's not me at all. The Lost in Translation thing, though, came along, and I don't know, it just happened. You know, I went for the audition. I was like, yeah, sounds like a cool, you know, I'd love to try this out. I'd love to do it. And it turned out to be an incredible experience. And after that happened, I thought, you know, if there was ever to be another movie that really spoke to me and I just thought, this will be an incredible experience and it'll really challenge me in some way, I would love to do it. And this movie, Kamataki, came along, which is a French-Canadian film about a boy who, his dad is Japanese and his mother is French-Canadian. And the beginning of the story starts where he jumps off a bridge and tries to kill himself, and this is in Montreal. And his mother, not knowing what to do, she's absolutely just exasperated, and she's like, Ken, I don't know what to do with you, you know, because his dad had, I need to also say, his dad has just died, and he was very devastated, and he couldn't really connect with his mom, and he was a very lost place in his life. So his mom said, I'm going to send you to Japan, some rinky-dink, super small town where your uncle lives. So Ken is sent to an area of Japan called Kamataki, which is actually a form of pottery. It's a very well-known, kama is urn, taki is for yaki, which means to bake. And so this little city is very well-known for for the way they bake, like, Japanese cups, and, you know, it's a beautiful little town. But he's sent there, and his uncle is a pottery master, and very eccentric, and so, kind of long story short, but he develops this relationship with his very eccentric uncle, and then also with the uncle's apprentice, which was me. And I had been in this pottery village studying under the sensei, or teacher, for 5 years. I'm this American woman who's been put in this very male-centric world for 5 years, and I've kind of lost sight, or I've felt like I've lost touch with my womanly part, or my womanly side, and so I'm kind of also searching. So we both discover a lot about each other through our relationship. So fire is kind of the underlining theme in the movie, of course, with, you know, the urn and everything in pottery, but it also goes through the whole I regain my fire or my passion, as does the main character, Ken.
So yeah. Is pottery used in it kind of like in Ghost? Kidding.
Okay, yeah, right? I know. So actually what happened...
Patrick
Swayze. Yeah, I know. It was not... Unfortunately, it was not that glamorous.
Glamorous.
Oh, okay. Cheesy. Yeah. But I had to learn how to use the kama.
Ah.
Because, the urn, because I'm supposed to be this woman that's been dealing with it for 5 years. That thing is so incredibly hot, right? So they took me in for a training for a week. And it was just, it's not at all a glamorous role, because that's not where I am as my character, you know? But I learned so much, and I just really, in many ways, I had to mentally really push myself I just mentally and physically, even with the urn and learning how to work with it, you know, and I picked it up relatively fast, but first, oh my gosh, I was so scared, you know, of the fire, because it comes out, it was like, you know, when you open the urn door that they have, and that scared me to death at first, right? And they kept telling me, you can't back away. You need to be very comfortable with the fire, you know, and you need to be like, you can't, even if you do this a little bit, you know, they'll be able to tell that, you know, you need to really develop that relationship with the fire. I'm like, oh my gosh. gosh, you guys aren't paying me that much, you know. But yeah, so it was an incredible experience.
So what you've mentioned video game voiceovers and stuff. Have you done any voiceovers for anime? In the US?
Well, not in the US. I did something for Japan and maybe for the rest of Asia. I'm not sure where it's being distributed actually, but for Hello Kitty.
Oh.
They put out a learn educational series, like DVD series, and I played Batsumaru.
Ah, so say something in Batsumaru's voice for people.
Okay.
Hi, minna, Batsumaru da yo. Mata kiite ne. Bye bye.
So what was that like, working, being a little blackbird or whatever he is, a little penguin?
So much fun. So much fun. However, I will say that voice is really tough on your throat.
I can imagine.
Yes.
So you're not
gonna, and your ears.
Yeah,
exactly.
So you're not going to be like reciting Shakespeare in Batsumaru's voice.
Yeah, no. And one day I showed up, because I think we must have done it for about a month. We went in for a few days a week, and because, you know, we had to give, yeah, especially I had to give myself, you know, a few days to recover from my last Batsumaru experience. So, and one day I walked in, and they're like, oh, Liesl, you're going to be singing today. I'm like, what? Singing in Batsumaru's character? You've got to be kidding me. And not just singing in Batsumaru's voice, but also singing in English and Japanese. I'm like, oh, kill me now.
Oh, what did they make you sing?
I don't even remember. It was an original song, I think. It was for the educational series. But, you know, one thing I've always found, though, that the more crazy the voice is, the funner you tend to have with it, because you just have to get rid of all your inhibitions. You know, you have to really put yourself out there. And so you have to come to a place where you're like, screw it. I don't care what people say. You know, I don't care what they, you know, I don't care if they look at me funny. I just need to go to that place in order to be that character or whatever. So, okay. It's in a way, it's a very liberating experience, I think.
So what does the future hold for you?
Good question. I did have a big audition a few days ago.
Don't know what it's yet for yet?
No, I do know.
Oh.
I don't know if I can say yes.
Video game?
Both, actually.
Oh.
Kind of both together.
Is this Dragon Age? Because there's a lot of people that... Okay.
No.
So? We'll find out later.
Yeah, I'll tell you off the record.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah, because I don't know if... You know, and I don't know if I'll get it.
Oh, yeah, they sign up. Like,
or you can edit it.
Yeah.
You're going to edit this anyway,
right? Oh, we'll edit it. Yeah. Well, mostly, like,
Yes, so the day that I left to come out here, I actually had the audition in the morning.
Yeah, it's like, I think what we'll do is, for our listeners here, we're going to go ahead and just cut that part, they cut little part of that out, just like the name of it and the name of the character, in case.
Yes, sorry guys.
Oh, it's okay. You don't get to know. But we do.
Yeah. And then I also, and then on that same vein, I have another video game that I will be doing that I'm not allowed to talk about either.
Oh.
So.
Not even the company, huh?
Yeah, exactly. I had to sign NDA, NDA form. So, but this will be for a character that I've voiced before. That's all I'll say.
Hello Kitty.
No, I know, right?
She'll be in Mortal Kombat. No, Hello Kitty be in Mortal Kombat 9.
Make a Hello Kitty fighting.
Well, they already
should.
Have it.
I would totally Choco love Cat. That.
Choco Cat's fatality
Choco
here.
Choco Cat.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
It's
like, which work do you basically prefer? Like acting, voice acting, or video game voice acting, or radio?
I love it all.
Just all of
they
it?
All, yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I look at it as they're all great experiences, and they kind of just really, they all sharpen different skills, which is what I really love about it. Even like last week when I did that simultaneous interpreting thing, which I'd never done before. I had no training in it at all, but I really love, you know, I love learning new things, and I think this is kind of a very consistent thing in this interview even, but I love pushing myself to the limit and seeing how much I can do, and just exploring new territories. So I would have to say, though, that radio is still my it's my first love.
How did you get that initial radio DJ job?
That's a very funny story, actually, that I was 19. Actually, I was 18 when I first started managing models in Japan. I would take them around. First of all, I would cast some of the models. I'd take them around to their respective auditions and jobs, and I would be the liaison between the model and the client, right? So I started doing that. One of our clients, his name is Mr. Kobayashi. He was like a one-man marketing company. One day he approached me and he said, "Liesl, I have a really big favor to ask you. I need you to show up at, I don't even remember, but said hotel, one of the big exclusive hotels in Japan. I think it was Teikoku Imperial Hotel. I need you to go there and I need you to act like you're my assistant because I'm going to be pitching for a radio station." Like, this radio station is looking for their opening campaign, you know, promotional campaign, advertising campaign. And he was going against some of the biggest advertising agencies in the world, which are, many of them are located in Japan, such as Dentsu, Hakuhodo, and then also McCann Erickson, right? So he said, I need to find something that's going to make me stand out. I want you to come. You don't need to say anything. Just come, show up.
Just
being
Caucasian?
Yes. Add the whole foreigner, the whole foreigner element, right? I'm like, what? This is the kookiest thing I've ever heard. Okay. So, you know, I show up in the suit, and I think I even wear, like, you know, fake eyeglasses, you know, so I can, like, look really business-like. And he introduces me as his assistant, saying, "Oh, Liesl grew up in Japan, but, you know, you can ask her about questions about American radio." Meanwhile, I'm listening to him introduce me, thinking, "No, you can't. I know nothing about radio in America, you know?" And thank God, no one asked me a question, not one, during the meeting. I'm here with, like, seven or eight men who put together this radio station. And you have to understand that, like, in Japan, you're only allowed to launch a radio station in, say, like in Tokyo, every 10 years. So it's a huge deal. Like, you actually have to apply for the license, say why you need your radio station, how it's different from all the other radio stations. It's a very long, drawn-out process. So they were very, I mean, there was a lot of money and a lot being put into this, right? So I was at that meeting, said nothing, and then, you know, continue managing models. Then one day, I get another call from Mr. Kobayashi, and he said, "Liesl, the guy who is the creator of J-Wave, is the name of the radio station, called me, and he just couldn't figure out why you were at that meeting." It's like, "Why is she there?" "She's my assistant." "How come she didn't speak? What's her background? What's the deal with her?" And he started asking all these questions, right? And then he explained that they're looking for people that are bicultural, or, you know, so someone like kind of like myself. And so I met with him, and they told me, you know, a lot about the radio station. And they're like, "We would love you to come in and do an audition." Okay. So I go in, totally fail. I do terrible, right? I don't know what to do. I'm like, they're like, "Okay, go ahead. You can just go ahead and talk. Free talk, as they call it. You know, talk about anything." Okay, I just totally bombed it. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to, you know, I didn't know my way around the studio or anything. So they put me on staff with the Morning Man, who's the one that nicknamed me Lisa Weapon. And once I started working with him, on, you know, for coordinating and research and stuff, I started DJing on my own for a very small kind of pirate radio station, and that's how I got into it. And I ended up getting a show, actually, with that radio station a few years later, but yeah, so that's kind of how I got into radio.
Would you ever go back into radio?
I would love to, yeah. I just love being able to create a world, you know, and using music and just using your voice and just being able to, like, I don't know, it's just, there's just something special for me with radio that I just love, yeah.
So, one thing as well, because, like, today is March the 12th. Yeah. We wanted to ask you a couple of questions about your thoughts on the recent quake and tsunami.
Yes. Well, first of all, I mean, in a way, it was, you know, living in Japan, we've all been expecting the big one, but none of us ever thought it would be something to the magnitude that what happened, you know, what happened. But I found out when I woke up in the morning at 4 a.m., just couldn't really sleep, and checked Facebook, and all of a sudden there were all these messages, you know, because I have most of my friends on Facebook are in Japan, so I'm reading all this stuff, and I'm like, shoot, what the heck did I miss? And there's footage, and there's pictures, and so then basically from 4 a.m., until that night, I was on Facebook the whole time, just trying to get feedback from people and make sure that the people that I knew or the loved ones of people that I knew were all safe and accounted for. And I mean, you know, it's like I'm very proud, and I think I mentioned this in the panel, but I'm so incredibly proud of Japan and the way they handled it. And I'm so glad that, even though, I mean, it's an incredibly devastating thing that happened, but it could have been so much more devastating, I think. And their strict building codes, I think, really saved them a lot. And even though, you know, I think that what a lot of people don't really understand is how the Japanese commute usually an hour and a half to work, and that's one way. So,
average?
Yes, hour, yeah.
Wow.
And so, and this happened during the day when everyone was in their offices, right? So people were stranded on these, you know, wherever their office was located, and had no way of getting home because all the trains had stopped. So I have many friends who walked for like 4 or 5 hours, yeah, to try to get home. And you know, I mean, there could have been a lot of really ugly things that happened with that, because that would be just such an incredibly frustrating situation to be in. But everyone really, I think, dealt with the situation very, very well. I know that Japanese are incredibly resilient, and I think that it'll take a very long time, but I'm sure that they'll build themselves back up. And I mean, you know, I think they have to. I think a lot of the world also relies on Japan for many things, business-wise and otherwise, culturally too. So, yeah, it is devastating though. Yeah, and I hate that, in some ways I really hate that I'm here and can't really help, you know, there's a limited thing, you know, amount of things that I can do being here in the States, but, yeah.
Well, I don't want to end it on a note like that,
yeah, sorry,
so,
no.
Let's talk about, what's your favorite memory of Japan?
I have so many.
25 years there, yeah.
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 I don't even know. I think it's a lot of the little everyday things. Like, Japanese love sweet potatoes. They have roasted. I guess it would be, yeah, roasted sweet potatoes, or I guess baked sweet potatoes, which are awesome, amazing. And one of my favorite things, even as a little kid, would be to go, once they start selling them in the fall, because it's very much a fall-winter snack, and would be to go and get my baked sweet potato. And they used to have these old men have this cart that they would pull, and they would yell yakimo, ishiyakimo, yakitate. They would always have that
like
little
an ice cream man.
Exactly. Which it means, yakimo means baked sweet potato. Ishi means baked with hot stones or on stones. And then ishiyakimo, yakitate means piping hot. So that's basically, yeah. So for me, that's one of the things that I miss. Especially when it gets to be the fall, winter season, and I'm like, oh, I would love to have a yakimo.
Thanksgiving sweet potatoes just don't come
through. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No. I do love yams, but no, don't compare.
So, since you've been in America, what things would you like, what things do you think they should have in Japan that they have in America, and what things that, aside from sweet potatoes, would you like them to move over to the U.S.? How would you like the cultures to mix?
Honestly, I would like to see more Japanese interacting with each other. Mm. Japanese tend to kind of stay to themselves. And one thing that I've found, and I don't know if, I'm sure it's not like this all over the States, I don't know, but people tend to be a bit more friendly,
yeah,
I think.
It's a little bit exaggerated at conventions.
Yeah, conventions is a bit exaggerated.
I think in America it depends on the city, the
yeah,
state.
As well, yes, yeah. And they also have eye contact. Japanese don't do eye contact very well. I mean, they're a little bit embarrassed too, you know, they think of it as... They, a lot of times when they'll talk to you, they'll be like this. And I just kind of wish that they would kind of open up a little bit more with that. You know, I think that would be, but I mean, culturally, they're taught that they're not supposed to. So, you know, it is, I mean, it's a part of, yeah, Japanese culture.
Like, but, no PDA.
Yes, exactly. Yes. What would I like to see here in the States besides yakimo? That's a good question. You know, okay, so I would like to see, and this is because I live in L.A.
Better public transit?
Yes! Exactly!
Better public transit.
Yes! Yeah, I mean, people, like, in L.A. never walk. I still love to walk. My friends who live there, they keep telling me, Lisa, you'll change. I'm like, no, I won't. Don't tell me I'm going to change. I'll do what I want to do, you know? But, I mean, and I think that, yeah, Japanese tend to walk a lot more, and like even with food, like everything is a little bit more in moderation, I find. It's not supersize me, whereas that's how it is here, and it's just such a kind of a strange thing for me. I'd like to see a little bit more, yeah, also, I would love to see people eat a little bit more healthy here.
It happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, yeah, corn.
Yeah.
It's in everything.
Yeah.
So you also had an interesting thing you mentioned about on public transportation in Japan. I thought that was kind of interesting. We could get that on the record. What is it they do if you use your cell phone?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Cell phones. Talking on cell phones are banned on both on buses and on trains. And especially on buses, if the driver sees you talking on your phone... he will call you out. He'll say, "Sumimasen, kētai dame desu." Or he'll say, "Kētai kitte kudasai." You know, something like that. You know, which means please cut off your phone. But yeah, they are very, very strict about that. And usually with trains, because yeah, I mean the train is, the conductor is way up here, right? So if you're in the middle car or whatever, the people riding the train will police you. So they will be the ones to say, "Kētai dame desu," they will actually approach you, which is very, really, when you think about it, if you know the Japanese as people, they do not do this kind of stuff. They're not at all confrontational, you know, and they don't approach and say, you can't do this, you can't do that. But when it comes to talking on the phones, they're very, very strict about that. Yeah, so that's another thing that does get hard to adjust to here, because people talk on their phones all the time, you know, but I mean, I don't want to hear the person next to me's private conversation, you know, and...
You can't not listen.
Yeah, you can't, yeah.
It's like hardwired into your brain.
Yes.
You only hear half of the conversation, you have to... You're intrigued.
Yes. And sometimes those are the people that have the voices that carry the most, it seems like.
And they always have the worst conversations. You're
this is what this person did. And it's just like, oh, man. Even with my headphones on, I still hear. Yeah.
So, you also mentioned at the panel cell phone coverage in Japan versus the U.S. I guess we could go over a little bit on that real quick.
I would say that cell phone coverage is so much better in Japan. When I had my phone, I had a very simple phone. I didn't really want like a super complicated, you know, keitai, as they call them, or cell phone. And I hardly had dropped calls. But coming here to the States, my first phone was an iPhone, and constant dropped calls. That was so surprising to me. I thought maybe it was my phone, right? I'm like, oh, I hate iPhone, man. And yeah, and then I found a lot of people told me that it's the carrier. But yeah, it just seems like internet, a lot of times internet access or the speed of internet, especially in some areas as well, is better in Japan on the whole. And definitely keitai or cell phones, I think.
Okay, here's a couple softball questions, I guess, to even this out. What's your favorite kind of music?
Favorite kind of music? I'll give you my favorite artist, Prince.
Ah, Prince.
Yes, I've loved him since I was 10.
He's been around.
He has been around.
Yes. And he's still touring.
Yes, I know.
If you could meet any celebrity or artist aside from Prince, who else would it be?
I've met Prince.
Oh, you've met Prince?
Yes.
Oh.
And he was awesome. I met him, I had to MC for him for a autograph session that he put together. It was kind of a fixed or, like a autograph session that was fixed or rigged, I don't know what you call it. But it was for a movie that he was trying to put out, and he needed footage of himself as a pop star signing autographs. And so I was doing the MCing for it. And of course, I adore him, but he's so small. And he has such amazing eyelashes. And he just, I was like, dude, you're so much more effeminate than I am. It's just like crazy.
Get away from me!
Yeah. I was like, yeah. But, I met him. Who would be another artist that I'd want to meet? That's a good question. I really love Anita Baker. I love a lot of soul artists. Very much into that.
Stars or celebrities?
Dustin Hoffman, I think. I really love him a lot. Yeah.
You stalking Dustin Hoffman?
Huh?
You stalking Dustin Hoffman?
Not yet.
Not yet.
I could, though.
You'd be like, you're keep sending him messages on Facebook or something. Probably. It's L.A.
Yeah. I did meet a lot of people, actually, on the red carpet. I was doing the red carpet, and that was fun. Like Hugh Jackman, who's great. Love him. Such a great guy. Jeffrey Rush. And he was also awesome. And I will say Sharon Stone. Not so awesome.
Didn't like Sharon Stone?
Oh, she was really rude. Wow, yeah.
Kind of like you were mentioned earlier.
Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah, and yes. You also got to work with Bill Murray.
Yes, Bill Murray was awesome. He was great. He's a very gracious actor. When they were filming Lost in Translation, they only had 2 weeks to film in Japan. Yeah, the Japanese government only allows a film crew 2 weeks because they don't want to disturb the city of Tokyo any more than that. So that's all they'll give you. So Sofia Coppola had to do all the daytime hotel, or had to do all the hotel shots at night. And then, of course, all the other shots were done around that. So they were working 24-hour days, pretty much.
Was the entire movie filmed in Tokyo?
I think so. They might have had to do retakes, just because of the time that they were dealing with, but yeah, I believe so. And Bill Murray was just always trying to uplift everyone, you know? I mean, the crew was getting tired, and when I went in, they had already done, like, I think a week of filming. So I'm sure that they were already kind of getting exhausted, but he was very good about, you know, keeping the humor going, and he was very, very nice to work with. Yes, Scarlett Johansson, on the other hand, I will just go ahead and say, incredibly difficult. She was always changing. She was like, oh, I can't do this, I can't do that, I can't do this. And, you know, it was just like very diva-esque, and she had not yet really broke as a, you know, she hadn't had her break really as a A-list actress yet. I mean, she was a child actress, but
kind of high maintenance for someone who wasn't
very high maintenance. Yes,
very well.
Yeah, but then the reason behind that was because everyone on the set and everyone in the back, you know, behind the scenes knew that this was going to be her big movie. And yeah, and Sofia Coppola was very she was a bit of a muse for Sofia Coppola. So yeah, so there was that whole dynamic. But
so what do you think of Anime Land Wasabi so far, this convention?
Oh, it's been great. I really love it. I just think everyone, it's so awesome to see everyone so excited about doing the cosplay and everything. And yeah, there's a lot of great energy going on. I've really enjoyed it a lot. And being as it's my first time,
convention?
No, but my first time here with Sabi, yeah, I love it. I hope to come back, absolutely.
Are there any other cons you're doing later this year?
Yes, I think I'm going to be doing one in Las Vegas in May. Maybe another one in the fall, yeah.
So what were the previous ones you did?
My first con was PersiCon in Alabama. Decatur, Alabama, which is very interesting experience because I didn't know what to expect from a con.
Yeah, how much time did you spend in America with, you mentioned that you came back for 1 year of high school to America?
College.
Oh, college.
Yes.
How much time did you spend in America overall?
Before that?
Before you moved back here?
Summers.
Summers?
Yeah, summers and then that 1 year.
Aunt and uncles?
Yeah, exactly. Like aunt and uncles.
What,
and sometimes.
What state?
Texas. Actually, Texas, we lived for half a year because my dad, he is a linguistics professor, and he was on sabbatical, so he was taking some classes and also teaching at U of T. Yes, was it U of T? Yeah, I think it was. Longhorns. Right? University of Texas,
yeah.
Isn't that? Yeah, okay. So he was teaching there, so I was there for half a year, and then Tennessee. And then my relatives are in West Virginia, so summers a lot of times were spent there. That's it.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Not bad.
No, what surprised you the most about these conventions when you first, for your first convention, what surprised you the most about anime conventions?
I think just their passion for anime and video games, and which, you know, and not a, of course not a bad surprise at all, but it's just so neat for me coming from always having to explain to people where I come from as a kid. You know, they're like, where do you come from? China? you know, it's like the whole thing of, oh, was your dad a ninja or a samurai? You know, being like, every time I came back to the States, I would have to tell people, no, we do not live in a grass hut in Japan. And no, you know, I mean, there's all of these, yeah, assumptions.
Did
or...
Did people think you were a military brat at all?
Or? Yes. And I still get that a lot, which, yeah, that's totally fine, because a lot of people do equate that. But, yeah, I think very pleasantly surprised at how much people know about Japan and how much they love it and they're really passionate about it. To me, that means a lot, just because I never got that as a kid, so it's kind of nice, yeah.
What misconceptions about Japan would you like to take the moment to dispel?
I don't know. That's a very good question. I would say, I don't know.
No.
I have no idea. Yeah.
So, how acceptable would you say watching anime is
in Japan? It's very accepted.
Just not to the level of otaku.
Well, yeah. Yeah, like I think that you will find mainstream Japan grew up with anime, but their approach to it will probably be similar to mine, I think, where they grew up with it a lot, but they don't necessarily know all the current manga and the current anime. It's also a huge... pride, they're very, you know, proud of the fact that they're known for anime and manga, and it's very much of a cultural pride, I think.
Aside from like otakuism, because from what we've heard on otakus before, and what's shown in some of the later Japanese anime and manga,
like
Welcome to the NHK, which was also a book. They talk about the hikikomori problem, mm-hmm. or the
meets.
Idea of people meets, yeah, not currently in employment, education, or training. A lot of people there's this underlining stream where a lot of people in higher up places are starting to try and crack down on manga and anime, like Ishihara in Tokyo, where they're trying to crack down on it because they're not sure that a lot of the more popular culture today is good for the youth. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that actually might even go a little bit deeper than that. I think that a lot of times anime and manga is also a way of escaping, and I think that's why it's been such a big part of Japanese culture. However, when you start to see people who are not of the norm, quote unquote, come out in Japan, you're also starting to see individuality. And Japan has always, you know, prided itself on being a very group culture, you know, very insular culture as a country. So I think that also comes into play with that. And honestly, I mean, Ishihara is very controversial. He has said a lot of things in interviews or in articles that I'm just appalled that he said as a politician. I mean, you know, I guess that goes for politicians everywhere, because I'm appalled sometimes at what they say here. But,
sometimes?
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah. And I know that he is also very right-wing, very much about old-style Japan. So he does not want to see any kind of individuality or... and I think they equate artistic things such as anime and manga to being being very individual. And if they do that, they won't be able to control the country. And in my opinion, that has a lot to do with it, I think.
So it's more or less that the problem with anime and manga is that a lot of it is very creator-focused now, where you have like Atito Kubo,
absolutely,
who does Bleach, and Akira Toriyama, known for Dragon Ball.
Yeah.
And these people become more popular from that. And you even have people like the voice actors or Seiyu from various shows, like Aya Hirano, or some of the people from K-On, which is a very popular one over there. But yeah, you see a lot of that happening, and it's kind of, I can see where they feel that it's falling apart.
Yeah.
So where do you see Japan in the future, if this continues?
I don't know, because I've been asked that question a lot. You know, like, where is Japan going? And
giant robots.
Yeah, right? I know. And I mean, Japan is at a very interesting place right now as a country, because they don't have very many kids. The birth rate there for the past 10, 15, 20 years even, maybe, has just totally dropped. And so as a country, it's very, you know, it's an older country now. And then, of course, you have the whole earthquake thing, and how's that going to really affect what's going on with Japan? And there's also the fact that everything is internet-based, right? And the Japanese, even though they study the English language for quite a few years, at least 7 or 8 years, their handle on the English language, or I should say their confidence level of the Japanese English language, is not very good. And so they tend not to use the internet that much. Even, of course, there's Japanese content, but they still don't use the internet nearly as much as we use it here. So, like, you know, printing out something on Google Maps, you know, like, a lot of times they'll fax a map, or they'll send a map, like, in order to get to a studio or something like that, they would actually send a PDF of a map, right? As opposed to saying, okay, this is where you need to go. Yeah.
And map.
Yes. Yeah. And so I don't know. And I think that they're going to have to once more find their niche, kind of in where everything is in the world economy. So I'm very interested to see what will happen. I mean, I have all the confidence in the world. They can be some of the most hardworking people in the world. And I believe that their quality of life compared to the average person here is not nearly as good. And yet they don't complain very much. They do what's called gaman. They gaman suru. Gaman means to hold it in. But of course, gaman, a lot of times, is really what has led to some of the most amazing anime and manga, because, you know, people use that energy that they have that they can't bring out. They'll put it out somewhere creatively or something like that. So, yeah, it's kind of an interesting, it'll be interesting to see what kind of direction Japan takes.
Well, thank you very much for doing this interview.
You're welcome.
And we will, of course, edit a thing out so yes, our listeners please. Aren't too disappointed. We already warned you we're going to edit that out, and we won't put out an unedited version of this. So,
thank you.
no problem. But yeah, anything final for our all three of our listeners?
皆さん、今日ありがとうございました。またね。Which means thank you very much in Japanese.
Yes. And
that's how it went down. That's how the interview went down. And please look forward to the rest of our Anime Land Wasabi 2011 coverage on the next episode of Radio DMG. I'm your host, Philip Wesley, and good night.
My name is Lisa Wilkerson, and please listen to Radio DMG.